From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Silvio Berlusconi is out. 17 years of his outsized personality, bunga bunga, and scandal-plagued politics over. Italians are done with him. But in his wake, an economic crisis, and they're counting on a stoic technocrat, Mario Monti, to ride to the rescue. Can this former European commissioner and numbers man save Italy? How does Berlusconi's mess go? And why did Italy put up with him for so long? This hour on Point, the fall of Berlusconi and maybe the rise of a new Italy. You can join the conversation. How will you remember the legend of Berlusconi? The women, the parties. How did he change Italy? And joining me from Rome is Silvia Poggioli. She's senior European correspondent for NPR. And Silvia, great to have you on Point. Thanks for coming aboard.
Great to be with you, Anthony.
So give us a sense, Silvia, of the range of reaction that you're hearing in Italy about Silvio Berlusconi's departure. How are Italians reacting? Relief? Hope? Is this really a new day in Italy?
Well, Saturday night, for several hours before he was supposed to hand in his resignation to President Napolitano, there were crowds gathering outside the president's building. And the mood was certainly one of great anticipation and great relief. There were cheers and hoots and everything when his car came, his arrived at the building. There was a lot of insults and things like that. But it was mainly young people, and there were young people who really had probably when they were born, Berlusconi was already on the political scene, and they had not known anything else. But believe me, there was a tremendous amount of sense of relief. And that certainly was the pervasive feeling I felt also walking through the streets of Rome yesterday. Of course, yesterday a rowdy crowd was bussed in by Berlusconi's party to cheer for him in solidarity outside his home. But more or less, I'd say there's a sense that it's a new era beginning. There are a lot of concerns. Not everybody is convinced that the next likely Prime Minister, Mario Monti, will be able to put the country back on his feet. But there's certainly a sense of more optimism than I have felt in a long, long time.
Mm. You know, I wanted to ask you sort of personally. I've talked to you many times over the years about Berlusconi. How surprising was this to you? In other words, did you think this day would come when it did?
Well, I'd say for about the last year, since last December, his decline has really been rather palpable. I mean, there was a very good chance that he could have failed a no-confidence motion last December, but he was given some time, and he was able to, woo back a lot of supporters, and he was able to manage. But he's been in a holding pattern now for the last year or so, and the decline has been incredible. And as the crisis got worse, as things got very bad in Greece, and there was this danger of then the contagion to Italy, people in his own party started abandoning. There was a sense of, jumping ship.
Mm.
It came quite fast, I'd say, but I think there was a sense that nobody felt he was going to make it to the end of the mandate of this prime minister, the next elections were slated to be in 2013.
So he wasn't going to make it till there. And of course, Silvia, big challenges confronting Italy right now and the Eurozone. But I want to just ask you a little more about the long career and legacy of Berlusconi. He spoke publicly yesterday evening for the first time since his resignation. What did he say?
It was a videotape message. He looked quite different from anything I've ever seen. There was no smile. There was no ebullience. He looked quite stunned, I'd say. He repeated much. He kind of echoed on purpose much of the text of what his very first speech when he was announced he was entering politics. There was a lot of rhetoric about his love of Italy, but it was both feisty and sort of depressed. I don't know how to say. He said, yes, we're going to defend Monti, but he would not take any responsibility for any of his failures. He said he resigned as an act of responsibility. He called it an act of generosity to the country. And he said, I will remain in Parliament and I will make myself heard.
Well, that's an interesting question. Is he going to come back at some point? I mean, we're all talking about this as though this is a sort of political obituary for Berlusconi, but he remains on the scene. Could he run again one day?
he could certainly run again if elections are held. He has said he will not run, but then he's often said he'll do something and then he does it. So to absolutely hold him to his word, I don't think that's such a great idea. But he could definitely run again. I think at this moment, the chances of his party doing very well are not good. But, you know, if a year or two goes by, the economic situation gets really, really bad, who knows? You have to keep in mind, this man has an enormous amount of power, economic power, information power. Yes, he will now probably, he'll definitely lose control of the state-run networks, but his own private TV networks and several newspapers he owns are an enormous way to get his message across.
Well, Sylvia, does that explain how he remained in power so long? You know, I'm reading a transcript from what you reported yesterday. He survived talks of bunga bunga orgies, more than 30 prosecutions that tainted Italy's international image and helped bring Europe's third largest democracy to the brink of bankruptcy. How did he remain in power so long? Why?
Well, there are many complicated. It's complicated to explain in one sentence. You can't. But one thing is, I think probably in any Western democracy, one person who has so much control of information, you know, could probably win power. How he could win power so many times, that's the good question. Why the last time, on the third occasion, Italians voted. But don't forget, again, he changed the electoral law. And he made it so that whoever got the largest number of vote, whichever party got the largest number of votes, would have a huge bonus in Parliament. And in 2008, his party just barely made 38%. That's quite a lot, but it's not a landslide. So I think it's a mistake to say, all Italians, how could they keep him in power for so long? Many Italians were fascinated. Many Italians really bought his dream of rags to riches, easy, you know, easy prosperity and all that. But that message really kind of became very thin as the economic crisis started hitting Italy. Another important thing is one of his large constituencies is tax evaders, and there are a lot of them in Italy. And we can't say that the Berlusconi governments, the various governments over 17 years, did much to crack down against tax evasion.
Which brings us to Mario Monti, the man who's been picked to set up a new government. He's an economist, respected. He's been dubbed as Super Mario. He faces an enormous challenge, though, setting up a government and guiding Italy out of this crisis. How big a challenge does he face?
It's a huge challenge because it all depends on how big a majority he'll be able to put together in Parliament. Already we see that Berlusconi's party, one of the major ally of Berlusconi in the government that has just ended, was the Northern League, and they have already said they're on opposition. They're not going to back him. Berlusconi has said he will back him, Monti, but his party is trying to put a lot of conditions. They want a very limited mandate. They want a very short time frame. So that's already on that side. Then on the other hand, Monti has to push through very, very tough austerity measures, much more than those that were passed the other day by Parliament. The European Union says that's not enough. Italy needs to do much more, big structural reforms. And he's going to find, obstacles on the left as well as on the right. They're going to be the unions will be very reluctant to see big changes in labor market reforms. There's a bunch of professional guilds, sort of closed professions in Italy, and they will not want to see any kind of liberalization. So it's going to be very tough.
Now, Mario Monti, a seasoned economist, he's had a lot of experience in Brussels as a European commissioner, but not in Rome. Does that hurt him or help him?
It would help to have probably a little bit more Machiavellian expertise, if you will, in the corridors of power in Rome. On the other hand, he has immediately struck a chord of sympathy with Italians. First of all, he's been going around. He doesn't have a house in Rome. He's been staying at a hotel, and he arrived rolling in his own suitcase. No chauffeurs, no bodyguards. And the other day, his wife arrived at the train station from Milan, and he went and picked her up at the train station. He didn't send somebody else. And he's been walking around the city. People are very, very thrilled to see this, because this is also a country where the political establishment has an enormous number of perks and privileges, fancy cars, and there are millions of cars with chauffeurs for even the most insignificant people, and they want to see the next government really crack down against all this waste from the political in the political establishment. And I think he's already given a very good signal in that direction.
Interesting, Sylvia, the way you describe Mario Monti there, self-effacing in a way that Berlusconi was flamboyant. I gather he represents quite an about face, at least in these early days.
Oh, I mean, it's totally the opposite in every sense. From physically, I mean, this guy has got a mane of his own gray hair. He's tall. He's multilingual. He's suave. And I don't think I need to describe what Berlusconi looked like or sounded like. I mean, it just seems like, you know, Mutt and Jeff. It's just so different. It's incredible.
Well, Sylvia Poggioli, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Sylvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk. She joined us from Rome. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Silvio Berlusconi, his cult of personality from Bunga Bunga to failing Euro economics. And joining me from Milan now is Beppe Severnini. He's an author, journalist, and columnist. He writes the daily Italians column for Italy's Corriere della Sera. He's also the author of a number of books, including La Bella Figura and Ciao America. His new book is Mamma Mia, Berlusconi's Italy Explained for Posterity and Friends Abroad. And Beppe Severnini, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's lovely to be back here. You are my NPR, you are my friend, so I'm trying to explain Berlusconi to you if you want to.
Well, we consider you a friend. Also joining us from Rome is political scientist James Walston. He's a professor of international relations at the American University of Rome and an expert on Italian politics. And James Walston, thank you for being here as well.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Anthony.
So there's a lot to talk about, not the least of which is how Italy gets out of this economic mess. But first, I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about Berlusconi's legacy. And Beppe Severnini, let me start with you. You've written about an economic legacy and a social legacy of the Berlusconi era. And let me ask you first about that economic legacy. Describe the crisis that Berlusconi left and that Italy faces right now.
Berlusconi left a crisis for two reasons. When we talk about Italy's got a public debt which is 120% of GDP, everybody concentrates on the debt. But in fact, the problem is also the GDP. Italy has not been growing at all. I mean, we grew less than Greece in the last 10 years. And actually, we grew in the Italian economy, grew less than everybody else. The only country that grew less than Italy in the last 10 years on the planet was Zimbabwe. I mean, for a man, a tycoon who, you know, entered politics saying, you know, I'm going to make you as successful, as rich as I am. Actually, yes, when he left, he was definitely wealthier, but no, we are not. That's the first thing. And so the percentage of debt to a non-growing GDP keeps growing. He actually brought it only from 107 to 120, which is not an improvement anyway. So that's the economic legacy. And all of the sort of perks that Sylvia Poggioli, I heard them with great interest, as always. Sylvia shares only her first name with Berlusconi, Silvio and Sylvia. But I tend to agree with her and not with him. So she's quite right when she says that all the perks of Italian politics and are there. You know, we have 72,000 what we call blue cars, so sort of official cars. In Britain, they have 225 or something like that. And then you have generous pensions. If you have been in Parliament once, you're going to have thousands of dollars or euros per month until you die. I mean, all those things, you know, he wouldn't think of doing. And of course, he was distracted by judicial tangles.
And we want to get to that, Beppe Severnini. Let me go to James Walston. James, you know, I'm remembering back to 1994. I did a little bit of coverage, actually, of Berlusconi's first run for office. He promised reforms, and a lot of what he talked about resonated with lots of Italians. I remember talking to small business owners who were being killed by taxes and red tape, and he promised a sort of American-style economic freedom and reform. How powerful was that initial message of reform?
Oh, I think it was very strong because he looked as if he was somebody new. He looked as if he could change Italian politics. He did. The only thing which he really did change was the language of Italian politics. Before 1994, the old parties used a stultifying jargon, which was referring to each other rather than referring to the public. Berlusconi changed that very dramatically, but it didn't make it, what he said was simpler, but it wasn't any truer. And he certainly hasn't followed through with any of his promises except to look after himself.
So he didn't make any progress on any of those reforms at all?
There was the famous contract with Italy in which he said he would lower taxes. He hasn't. And he has certainly not liberalized in any way, made business more flexible. The Heritage Foundation has it's very much a free market neoliberal foundation, but it has a survey of business friendliness of the world's countries. And at the top, you have people like Hong Kong and Singapore, with the United States third or fourth or fifth. And in the top two, you want to start a business, it'll cost you $50 or $100, and it'll take you half an hour or an hour. The U.S. is a little bit more. In Italy, it is years and many thousands of dollars. Mm. And as Beppe was saying, you have problems, businessmen, and Sylvia was saying, businesses have huge problems just getting by. Italy is 76th on I think last year's Heritage Foundation list. And that just is not, it's hopeless for somebody who is a businessman and said he would make life easy for businessmen.
Beppe Severgnini, we mentioned economic legacy. You've also written about the social legacy. What is Berlusconi's social legacy?
Well, you have a commander in chief in America. We had, because he's gone now, an absolver in chief. Basically, he absolved us for all the sins we have committed and those we are only thinking of.
Let me just to be clear, you said an absolver in chief, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
From absolving,
no.
Yes.
Sure.
And the country under him stopped growing politically and economically and civic societies. Berlusconi told us only and always what we wanted to hear. And if I may, that's a very bad way to raise children and nations. Misbehaving badly, he made clear, we could misbehave as well. A little, maybe. Fiscally and otherwise. And if you think that's a heavy legacy.
Yeah. He faced some 30 prosecutions, corruption, tax fraud. He's alleged to have paid for sex with a minor. Many of those cases continue going on. Why did Italians put up with that for so long? Maybe, Beppe Severgnini, you just sort of explained that. They saw the sinners that they were in Berlusconi, and that worked for them?
Well, that's a part of that.
Yeah.
I've written a book. I'm not going to sum up my book here. But
sure.
The book, thank you for quoting it, Mamma Mia, I try to explain that. Sylvia mentioned one of the factors, which I call it the Truman factor, the fact someone helped us think in terms of media control and all that. For instance, lots of people in the media abroad, and I have so many friends telling me, oh, well, you got the internet now. I mean, television is not as important as it was. But hold on, I have a figure here which I think is fascinating. There is something called netindex.com about, how quick is download from the internet. We are number 70 in the world after Kazakhstan and Rwanda. That means that Berlusconi television is really very important, and you have 5 million club out of 50 million voters who really are informed about what goes on, and they probably, if you were in Italy, these people would listen to NPR. But 5 is only one-tenth of 50 million. That's one reason I mentioned. And there are many others. I just mentioned two. If you take the Signoria from the Medici, you remember in Florence?
Sure, the form of government during the Medicis, right?
Yeah. Yeah, in the Renaissance. I mean, the attitude of too many Italians towards political power is still that one. That was the only form of government that we invented. That's original to Italy. And it's somehow down in our political DNA. In America, you have this attitude towards power. Okay, we put you there. That could be a senator, a congressman, a President Obama. Doesn't matter. I mean, we put you there. You're now powerful. But hold it, because we're going to watch you. And be careful what you do and what you promise and so on. In Italy, the attitude to many people is different. You know, how cool we have, you know, Il Signore and his excesses. And you leave those with a sort of amused complicity. And that's a real disaster. I mean, sometimes in America you go too much and it's become cynical towards everything comes from power and everything. All the rhetoric about Washington and the Beltway and all that. But in Italy, exactly the opposite problem. You know, we are far too forgiving towards power because it's back in the century we are, and so on and so forth.
Interesting.
You tend to side with the never with the judge, with the authority, but also always with the small man. And Berlusconi was very, very clever in using that. You know, I'm one of you. I talk about women, about soccer, about...
Sure. Yeah. James Walston, let me come back to you and just talk about this enormous power that Berlusconi mentioned. Beppe Severnini made reference to it. So did Silvia Poggioli. Even while he was prime minister, he retained control of TV stations, newspapers, a soccer team, advertising companies, on and on. Inconceivable, this kind of conflict of interest to Americans. What happened to efforts in Parliament to limit that power?
Very, very little. I want to pick Beppe up on one thing. Yes, Italy invented the Signoria, but Italy also invented the Republic. Here and here, where I sit, was the modern Roman Republic, which Garibaldi and Mazzini fought for. So there are other models, not just the Medicis and the like, and the popes. But yes, Berlusconi certainly copied a papal and signorile model. The conflict of interest, I think, is probably the worst and most lasting element. There's always been some part of conflicts of interest, and as you said, the Americans have it seriously ingrained that you cannot have it, from the president down to the municipal dog catcher. You have to declare your interests, and if you have conflicts, those have to be dealt with. President and vice president are not legally obliged, but for 40 years they have. They have put their wealth into blind trust, and they have done the best they can. Here, the only law which was passed, the centre-left didn't pass any laws when they were in power. Berlusconi did pass a law which supposedly governs conflicts of interest, but what did it do? It said you couldn't be an executive at the same time as being a politician. So he gave up being the president of the Milan soccer team. He'd still maintained his ownership of not just the media set and the television empire, but also the whole publicity gathering and distributing company, Publitalia, which is in a way far more important, because you turn off advertising, and any other outlet just dries up. So that is a lasting legacy, and the illegality which he has introduced. There's, again, always been a degree of illegality in Italy. You just have to look at the roads and the parking and the way in which tax is avoided. But Berlusconi raised it to a model for everybody and got away with it.
Mm. Bob Connolly writes, one of our listeners on Facebook, what makes you think he is over? He still owns the media in all of Italy. He will still control whoever he puts in power. I want to come back to that question, gentlemen. But first, I'd like to get some callers into this conversation. Let's go to Anthony, who's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. Being of Italian extraction and going to Italy many times and having Italian family still there, the real problem is not Berlusconi. Berlusconi is just a metaphor for what's wrong with Italy. The fact of the matter is Italians, even 150 years later, don't think of themselves as belonging to one nation. There's still regional, provincial, city-state mentalities. It's still assumed that if you are able, for example, in shops, to cheat a customer, it's morally okay. They take a blind eye to illegal immigration, the church, the mafia, the government. There's a level of deep-rooted corruption. I think one of your earlier guests mentioned about the taxation problem. The Italian elite pay nothing.
Yeah.
They pay absolutely nothing.
Anthony, you put a bunch of things on the table here, and I'd like to turn some of those points over to our guests. Beppe Severnini, respond to Anthony's points. Specifically, I mean, this idea that the Italian people can't seem to agree on the sort of concept of nationhood, that they're locked in this sort of antique idea of regionalism that holds them back. True?
First of all, let me tell you, Anthony, and to the other Anthony, that I just been to Rhode Island, to Providence, and I was at Brown. And in Rhode Island, you have your share of colorful Italian characters. But of course, Berlusconi is another league compared to what you have over there. But let's say that it is true, but probably less than in the past. I think Italy is growing. Italy has been celebrating its 150th anniversary birthday as a one country this year. And you have, if you live in Italy, I can really tell you that Italia, not only when we win a World Cup in soccer, we actually know we belong to the same country more than we did 20, 30, 40 years ago. You can see that in many details. The president of the Republic, Napolitano, who's the only Italian national, together with Mario Draghi, who's now heading the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, those two Italians were absolutely crucial in sort of engineering this transition. Everybody else, including the Italian opposition, center-left, did nothing about it. I mean, those two Italians. And the president Napolitano is so popular in Italy. He's got an amazing 89% approval rate because he's like a father-like figure that we need. And that shows that Italians are not that divided. I can tell you that we really love our hometown, ba-ba-bum, but it is true that we are slowly getting there. And you can see it in many little things. If you had a referendum tomorrow, you know, the Northern League, you know, they want the Northern to go on, speaking from Milan. Okay, we have a nationwide referendum. The question is, do you want it to split Italy? The North goes, you know, on its own, being rich and wealthy, blah, blah, blah. And the South, and the answer will be a sound no, because I think most Italians want to stay together. The other thing is more complex, but maybe we'll get to there later, the legality. We have, it is true, a morality a la carte. How about that? That doesn't mean that everybody is dishonest, because simply it's not true. A lot of good Italians around the world, and in America you have so many of those, are really proud to be Italian. They try their best. They fight hard against stereotype. We're not Sopranos. We're not Jersey Shore sort of. And Berlusconi seemed to enjoy to convalidate all the stereotypes and to kind of and he couldn't care less, and it was, and lots of Italians suffered for that, and I'm so happy that now Mario Monti represents a different kind of Italy, which, believe me, is there. There are millions of serious, hardworking, honest, reliable Italians.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the legacy of Silvio Berlusconi and who exactly is this new leader, Mario Monti. My guests this hour are Beppe Severnini, author, journalist, columnist. His new book, all about the iconic leader, is Mamma Mia, Berlusconi's Italy Explained for Posterity and Friends Abroad. Also with us is James Walston, professor of politics at the American University in Rome. And let's go right to a caller. Antonio is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Antonio.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for taking my call. I have a point to make. I am Italian. So I have a point and a question for Mr. Severnini. And I want to start with a question for Mr. Severnini. I should like to know which kind of book he will write after that he finished to spread rumors, unproved rumors about Mr. Berlusconi. And the point is that Italians have to be seen with Italian perspective. For us, Berlusconi was representing Italy, and is the Italian, the average of Italian, we are not, is not a scandalous bunga bunga for me and for 90% of Italian, whatever Mr. Severnini says, probably could be in this country, but not in Italy. And Berlusconi was the best that we had at that time. personally, I should like to be represented by Berlusconi much more than Mr. Severini or any other politician that are...
All right, well, Antonio, you've put a couple of things on the table there, and I'd like to have Beppe Severini respond. But Beppe Severini, there's Antonio calling from Newburyport, Mass, a vote of confidence for Berlusconi, that we have to look at him, within the Italian context, and I guess not be too judgmental from abroad here.
Well, first of all, let me tell Antonio that you live in America, you know what Americans say, and not only Americans, is right or wrong my country. It's not right or wrong my government. There's a huge difference. I know lots of American colleagues who are very critical with George W. Bush, for instance, publicly writing books and newspapers and broadcasting. I mean, we're journalists. We're not diplomats that, first of all. And second, I love my country, and I don't think he was well represented by Mr. Berlusconi. I don't think that I spread rumors. I think Bunga Bunga Party affected the life of a person. You cannot run a big country and spend your evening with, until the wee hours of the morning with young girls, and then put some of them in parliament, and then using your bodyguards to protect that kind of life, and then rushing to see your friend Putin and not to go to China and India, and then on and on and on. I mean, there's not rumors. I mean, if you think you were, Antonio, of course you voted for him. You think you were represented by Mr. Berlusconi. I don't. I think the majority of the Italians agree with me, even more now, but always agreed with me. He had enough votes to be in parliament. I always call him my prime minister. I didn't say it was a coup d'etat, but I don't see why I should be on the radio saying that I'm proud and to be represented by him. I am was not proud at all, and I don't think should you.
James Walston, let me get you back into this conversation. The fact that Berlusconi was able to hold on to power as long as he did, we've talked about some of the reasons, how he amassed power, certain amount of corruption, of course. But what does it say, I guess, about the weak state of the political opposition in Italy for all those years?
You're absolutely right. Apart from his media control, which Sylvia described very well, and apart from his undoubted charm, he's a very good performer. He's a very good salesman. He started off as a salesman and he continued as a salesman. And a politician has to be a good salesman and present his message. He was able to present a dream, and many Italians bought into that dream for a long time. And however much we find his behavior distasteful and some of it illegal, we can't deny that. But the other main reason, it was the opposition, the lack of opposition or the division among the opposition. They were not able to express a plausible leader, except for Prodi, and they were not able to express a plausible and united, continuously united set of policies. And that worked very well for Berlusconi in 2001 and, of course, in 2008 as well. But I think if I can add to the answer to Antonio, that the illegalities, the proven illegalities, because Berlusconi has never been convicted, but it has been shown in courts that he did things which were illegal at the time. There are a number of things which he did which have never been proven one way or another. He has never explained where his wealth came from. There are implications and suggestions. The Bank of Italy inquired into that 40 years ago. And that is 35 years ago, and that still has not been worked out. These are things which other Western leaders, as a European, equally, as a European who's lived in Italy for that long, I do not at all feel represented.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Boca Raton, Florida. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Very well.
I have a quick point I'd like to, a fact I'd like to actually check up with your gentleman from Italy. A friend of mine actually came from the country recently, and he was studying here, and he actually came from Milan. And he was actually quite rather, I would almost say even bitter, about the fact that it was his point of view that from the folks from Milan were making basically all this industry and basically paying for the taxes for the entire country, and that just about all the money was basically being taken from them and shipped down towards Naples. And I really don't have any other way to check on the idea of this stuff, but is that the general impression of how the country is run?
Well, Beppe Severnini responded there to Eric, this idea of the way wealth is gets redistributed from the north to the south. Of course, the north-south divide, a longstanding issue in Italy.
Well, it's a problem, of course. Only a few regions, they're called special regions, like Sicily, Sardinia, and Valle d'Aosta, and Trentino Alto Adige, they have the right to keep 90% of their income from taxes. They keep it there, where it's produced. Everybody else put in a sort of central pot in, and is distributed for there. And it is true the sum of public money in Italy serves as a kind of social security of a kind. I was trying to see here that in a figure that in Palermo, I think the local council cost local taxpayers, actually all taxpayers, so much more than any other council in the north. And you have lots of those examples. And so we do have a problem there, absolutely. But, and a failure to, you know, to bring up, let's say, and improve the south of the country has been a big failure for us all, and I'm talking as a northerner because it's a collective failure. But it didn't happen in the German managed to sort of bring in and improve eastern Germany. The British managed to sort of somehow improve northern England and so on and so forth. But I think it's the possibility is still there. Basically bring back legality. I call it the Dostoevsky principle, crime and punishment. I mean, if you do things wrong, you should be punished for that. And in fact, it doesn't happen in Italy. As I said before, people tend to see that, after all, power is antipatico. Mm-hmm. And the person who's caught doing something is simpatico, because the awareness and distrust of authority is so ingrained, and it goes back centuries, that we really have to work on that. Otherwise, you will never have the sort of popular support for the sort of civic society changes that we need. We need the new social pact, nothing else.
Well, Beppe Severnini, let me ask you about those changes that you need. And by way of doing that, I wanted to sort of move forward and talk a little bit about Mario Monti. And I want to play a brief clip. This is ex-European Union Commissioner Mario Monti, who has now been charged with forming Italy's new interim government. Here he is speaking at a press conference recently about the challenge that he faces.
Our efforts will be aimed at sorting out the financial problems,
at
growing again, thinking of social fairness too. We owe this to our children. We need to give them a tangible and dignified and hopeful future.
So that's Mario Monti, who's been charged with setting up the next Italian government, speaking through an interpreter at the BBC. James Walston, let me ask you about this mild-mannered, self-effacing economist and Brussels bureaucrat. He's as different from Silvio Berlusconi as anyone could be. Is he who Italy needs right now?
He wasn't exactly a Brussels bureaucrat. He was a commissioner.
A commissioner.
And he was a commissioner for competition, which was a very tough job, and he exercised it in a mild-mannered way, but with extreme rigor and extreme... He was very good at getting his job done. He took on Bill Gates, and he won. As a monopoly commission. So he enforced the European antitrust legislation. So he is not just a sweet professor of economics who is good at doing sums. He's also somebody good at working the lobbies and working the institutions in a way which is extremely moral, as we heard in that clip. He has said since being appointed as Prime Minister designate that he will try and deal with privilege. He knows very well that if he's going to get any of the austerity packages through, they have to be seen to be fair. And some of the privileges of politicians, which are outrageous, will have to go, and they'll have to go fairly quickly. And that will be a big battle, because he has to get these things through Parliament. But he has some momentum on his side now.
Well, let me ask you about getting those things through Parliament. Those are big challenges, James Walston. He clearly has knowledge, respect. President Napolitano of the president, Napolitano, and economist. But does he have the political experience to navigate the politics of Rome?
He probably doesn't, but I think he can learn. He can learn it very quickly, and he has one great advantage, which is the catastrophic position that Italy is in at the moment. Today, the spread between German bonds and Italian bonds went down a bit, and the interest rate on Italian long-term, medium-term debt went down a bit. That will probably go down further when he actually his government is sworn in. But if he doesn't do something fairly quickly, the spread will continue, will start rising again, and the cost of Italy's borrowing will start going up. So he's got to act quickly, and that will act as a big lever on recalcitrant politicians. He still has to get, he obviously has to get everything through Parliament, and if he can't get it through Parliament, he can point to the politicians saying, these people are preventing the Italian recovery, they are forcing a collapse on the euro, a collapse in the Italian economy, and that's drastic stuff. So he can probably manage to do that with that threatened big stick.
Beppe Severgnini, I'd like to get your input on sort of the challenge that Mario Monti faces. Here's a web comment from one of our listeners who calls himself or herself Motivations. The letter goes like this. The unions killed Italy. They haven't picked up the trash in Naples in months. I've got an uncle in Bologna who retired as a teacher at 53. He got a pension, was able to work another government gig at the same time. A reference there to the kind of reforms that I guess Mr. Monti will have to take on. What do you see as his biggest challenge, and how hopeful are you that he can get it done?
I wrote a column today in the FT this morning, and I explained that Italians, we are not stupid. We may be careless and emotional, but not stupid. In an emergency, we don't sort of laugh it out with Silvio. We rush to Dr. Monti's emergency room.
Right.
And you don't stay in the emergency room forever. Obviously, you need to be, you know, to be sort of bring. You have to go to the general hospital and then one day out of the hospital into normal life. That's a pattern. Of course, we are in a sort of emergency room mode. And at this point, I think everybody should give up something. Your listener, in her comments, she mentioned the unions. Of course, the unions and the political parties and professional guilds in Italy. Is that Berlusconi in that one, he said once, one thing I do agree with, he said it's very difficult to do things, even as prime minister in Italy. That's partially true. But it is true that in Italy you have enough power to block other people doing things. So if we want to help Mario Monti to sort out this mess, we should all give up something. I know I have a good income, and I come from a sort of wealthy background. I'm very lucky. I know that I will have to pay a wealth tax. I'm prepared to do that. I think Mario Monti is in a position to ask me for that money. Berlusconi was not. And that's why it's good that he's gone. But and then you have other people who don't have my income or my background. Maybe they have to stay a little longer in work and accept the idea that we're going to retire later. And the unions should understand that there is no way in Italy, in order to guarantee people in work with a job, you keep out a whole generation. One young Italian out of three is out of work. So it's a collective effort. I mentioned before that we really need a new social pact. I think it's time. We blew it. A chance back in the early 90s after the Clean Air investigation. Silvia Poggioli knows all about this, and I know she's been telling you all about this. We blew it in the early 90s. We got out of that. Instead of a catharsis, we got Berlusconi and his crowd and his promises. Now we got a second chance after this is decline. You know, other countries decline. You look at empires. Look what happened to Portugal, to Greece. See lots of example around the world. It's not, you know, you don't belong to the sort of club of G8, whatever, industrial, forever. So it's up to us, and I think it's only right. We have to deserve that our spot in the world.
So a second chance, Beppe Severgnini,
is not enough.
Sure. James Walston, we literally have 10 seconds left, but I want to get a final comment from you. A second chance, are you optimistic that this really does represent a new day in Italy?
Absolutely. Italy, every 20 years or so, every generation or so, reinvents itself. And they say, right, this time we're going to get it right. They haven't, but they have changed, and they have, and it has become a different, and I think most of the time, certainly in the last 100 years, a better country. This is another chance, and it's starting off very well, at least with Monti.
Well, we'll be watching it. We want to thank both of you gentlemen for helping us understand it a little better. James Walston, Professor of International Relations at the American University of Rome, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Beppe Severnini, Italian journalist, author, and columnist. He's author of Mamma Mia, Berlusconi's Italy Explained for Posterity and Friends Abroad. Beppe Severnini, thank you so much.
We'll make it. We're a comeback country. You'll see.
Well, we wish you all the best. And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.